This is Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis, and the race is on. Election season. The KCRW voter guide is up online, ballots are on the way, and it is a sprint to the finish line. Voting ends November 8th, and this is a midterm election, an off-presidential year, when typically the party in power in Congress loses seats. But this year, with Roe versus Wade overturned and election deniers on the ballot, a new GOP majority in the House doesn't seem quite as inevitable as it once did. And indeed, the path to control of the House may pass through Southern California. One newly redrawn congressional district in Riverside County could be among the closest races on election night. And as part of KCRW's coverage of the midterms, Matt Gillum has a look at the candidates rounding the final turn into the home stretch.
When Republican Congressman Ken Calvert first took office in January of 1993, Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You was at the top of the charts, and President Bill Clinton was enjoying his first term in office. Calvert has represented parts of his hometown of Corona and Riverside for a generation and weathered multiple cycles of redistricting. Claremont McKenna government professor Jack Pitney sums up the congressman this way.
Ken Calvert is, if you went 20 years ago and looked in a dictionary under the word Republican, you would have seen a picture of Ken Calvert.
But the seemingly unshakable incumbent now finds himself in what many see as the toughest political battle of his long career, thanks to redistricting.
If Calvert were running in his old district, this wouldn't be much of a contest. But given that it's a highly competitive district, it's a lot harder to predict.
Following the 2020 census and the redrawing of political maps, the latest district Calvert would represent, California's 41st, is deep purple. Data shows 36% of registered voters in the district are Democrats. The exact same percentage are Republicans. And just under 20% have no party preference and could hypothetically go either way. The heart of Calvert country, Norco and Corona, is still in the district. But now, progressive oasis Palm Springs and its large LGBTQ population are drawn in as well. Lisa Middleton, Palm Springs' transgender mayor, is part of the state's first all-LGBTQ city council. She says with Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas questioning the basis for legal same-sex marriage, she's ill at ease about the prospect of being represented by Calvert.
Across my city and across many parts of the Coachella Valley, there are individuals that are in my age group who grew up at a time that they could go to jail for expressing their love. Many of us never dreamed we would have the opportunity to marry the person that we loved. We have now. We are not going to give that up.
While Calvert supported a bill this summer which would codify same-sex marriage in federal law, the vote was an outlier. Over his 30 years in the House, he's consistently voted against LGBTQ advancement. Calvert didn't respond to KCRW's interview requests. In July, he told the LA Times the country has changed in the last three decades, and he believes the decision legalizing same-sex marriage is settled. The log cabin Republicans of Coachella Valley told KCRW in a statement they've had discussions with him about his position on LGBTQ issues and are confident he'll be an ally to the gay community. Rather than be a culture warrior like some of his fellow Republican representatives, political scientist Jack Pitney says Calvert is what's known as
a district guy. He focuses on issues that are of concern to the district, to inland California, and simply has not assumed a high profile in the national controversies. We're not talking about Marjorie Taylor Greene here.
Some of the district guy things his campaign website touts: getting federal dollars to help local hospitals, recommending hundreds of Riverside County students to the military academies, and securing funds to improve the ever-congested 91 freeway. Here's what Calvert would prefer to talk about.
I'm Ken Calvert. Every time we get gas or check out at the grocery store, we feel the pain of Bidenflation. That's why I've supported policies to increase American energy production and suspend the California gas tax.
Calvert's Democratic opponent in the race for the 41st district is a gay 38-year-old former federal prosecutor. Will Rollins is running on the fallout of the January 6th insurrection.
After helping D.C. track down some of the people in Southern California who attacked the Capitol, that was what motivated me to get into this. While those of us in federal law enforcement were responding to that attack, Calvert was voting to decertify the election, voting against an investigation.
Rollins looks to be the candidate making the law and order argument to voters, and he believes it's working.
The moderate Republicans, the independents, there is major movement among them towards candidates who are committed to the rule of law in our Constitution, and that has really resonated with them.
That's a good thing, says Claremont McKenna's Jack Pitney. He self-identifies as a never-Trump former Republican and thinks the precarious position of democracy writ large should be priority number one this November.
The threat to democracy is something that voters ought to be vitally interested in. It ought to be top of the agenda, but it's not clear that it really is.
By positioning himself as the one standing for American ideals, Rawlins thinks he can win over voters who may identify as Republicans but have had enough of Trumpism.
You know, as my aunt said, I didn't leave the Republican Party. The Republican Party left me. You have an opportunity right now to send a message to your party that it can recenter itself. And if you vote for somebody who you ordinarily wouldn't, even if they're a Democrat, send that message.
It's unclear if the message is coming. The Cook Political Report, Sabato's Crystal Ball, and Politico all had the 41st district as either likely or leaning GOP at the start of this month. As Rawlins and Calvert barrel down the home stretch towards November 8th, the question is, will it be a runaway or a photo finish? For KCRW, I'm Matt Gillum.
Still to come on GLA, an LA punk icon who weathered the early years in La Puente, played in a bunch of bands for decades, and more recently is headlining a band of his own. Kid Congo Powers is all grown up and writing it all down. That's yours on the other side of this.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Back now with more of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. What do you do if you're raised in La Puente on a diet of rock and roll and second-run drive-in horror flicks? When between David Bowie and the tough boys down the street, you realize there's another, more fabulous way to dress and be. You start a band. Some new kind of kick. Something I ain't had. That's what Brian Tristan did, becoming Kid Congo Powers and helping form the famous LA punk group The Gun Club. He would go on to join The Cramps, whose song you just heard right there, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and more. And he's got a new book out called Some New Kind of Kick, from the name of the Cramp song that you just heard, telling stories from those days. And he's here to talk more about it with us. Kid Congo, welcome to you.
Hey, good to be here.
Your story starts in La Puente. What was it like growing up in La Puente?
Well, you know, it was a new suburb, at, you know, when I was super young, you know, and yeah, very, very good, very mixed, you know, Hispanic, white, you know, Asian, everything you could think of, and yeah, it was you know, I think I wrote in the book, and you said in your intro, I had two movie theaters nearby, lots of bike riding into the city of industry, which was the next little burg, and you know, got into. Making trouble and having fun.
Making trouble. You obviously have gone all over the world in the time since La Puente, and it feels like you've interacted with pretty much everyone involved in rock and roll since the 1970s. What made you decide to write about it and to share these wild stories?
Well, age was one thing. You know, actually, I finally got some time to reflect. You know, I've been working the whole time. You know, I make records. You know, some are popular, some go under the radar, but I never stop working on things. And I think I was just moving so fast, and there was just no time for reflection. So when I moved out of New York City around 2006, I started scribbling, you know, with the intention of writing a book. And little did I know that I had bit off quite a big piece of something to chew, and it was going to take longer and much more work. So, but it's been a long gestation.
Speaking of wild stories, when you were in Nick Cave's band, The Bad Seeds, it showed up in a Wim Wenders film called Wings of Desire.
I want to tell you about a girl.
So how did that come about? I mean, not every band winds up in a vendor's film.
If you're Nick Cave in a bad seat, you do end up in a Wim Wenders film. It was an incredible experience, you know. It was one of my first duties as when I joined Nick Cave in the Bad Seeds. And, you know, I was aware of Wim Wenders films and who he was. And I was super honored. And everyone actually in Berlin knew exactly what a big event that was and what an honor it was. Everyone in the band knew, you know, Wim was a notorious, you know, not notorious, a well-known music lover. And even he had told me at the shoots that he had seen the Gun Club when he was in Los Angeles. And, you know, he knows his stuff. And so it was a beautiful, beautiful thing.
You know, a lot of your early work and early life seems to be figuring out, and you know, this is sort of the rite of passage for many young LGBTQ people, right? Figuring out your sexuality, who it was safe to talk to about it with. You know, you were almost living this double life, going to school in, you know, fairly normal clothes, but then, you know, you would go out at night and, you know, you'd be all done up in your homemade flashy clothes, right? What was that yeah. like?
You know, it was, to me, it seemed a very normal thing to do, you know, express yourself. You know, it was because, you know, things glam rock is most, of course, David Bowie, at, you know, in his Ziggy Stardust incarnation. It was an amazing, you know, role model and actually a very freeing touchstone, definitely for a teenager at that time, you know, because he was, you know, an alien, a bisexual, or an androgynous, you know. It was exactly how an adolescent kid feels at the time, you know, like an alien from outer space. You know, it was a complete identification analogy, and he gave the go ahead to go ahead and dress glam and you know, feel that part of me and not be afraid of what that was, you know. And so, yeah, it was perfect for an adolescent kid, you know, to latch on to and take it and run.
Take it and run. What about when you were doing music, though? Were you out to your bandmates when you were in the Cramps, when you were in these other bands?
Yeah, I get asked this a lot. I was out to people who knew me.
Yeah.
You know, that was never a secret. And when I started doing music, there was like no audience. There was no platform to be out, really. And, you know, and when I came into punk rock, I encountered so many, the first wave of Los Angeles punk rock was so many queer people, you know, trans people, queer people, and every kind of, you know, person who might, you could say, you know, I think disenfranchised is a little bit of a strong word, but a little misfitty, you know, people who didn't fit in. And this was a voice for people who didn't fit in or who were trying to figure out who they were. And punk rock was just a really perfect place. And it was a level playing ground. Everyone was welcome. Idea was king, you know, you know, being queer was, in any sense, was bucking the system. And that's, to be a good punk rocker, you had to buck the system.
And speaking of all that, you've played with some truly over-the-top front men, haven't you? I mean, Nick Cave, obviously, Lux Interior from the Cramps, Jeffrey Lee Pierce and the Gun Club. You have any favorites?
No.
Is it like picking your
they
children?
They're all pretty wonderful. They're all pretty amazing, you know, people. Yeah, speaking of people who actually, you know, although metrosexual or whatever, you know, they were people who blurred the lines with androgyny and sexuality. But they were equally, I thought, you know, everyone's like, wow, you had the most, you were with the most extreme people. But, you know, you have to know I started out with Jeffrey Lee Pierce. So I thought being absolutely extreme was just a normal thing, you know. Hmm. So one was not as weirder than the other. One was more interesting than the other, more like it. And yeah, so to me, that was just my normal day-to-day life, was being with these extreme, what people saw as extreme things. And I just saw maybe monsters, but very beautiful monsters.
And of course, now you're the front man, right? You've got the band Kid Congo Powers and the Pink Monkey Birds. You've had it for some time now. But you are, or have been at least, collaborating with a lot of other folks too. One song that you play in that band is actually a Gun Club song called She's Like Heroin to Me. She is like an island swimming pool, but she will never know that she is there. We sit together drunk like our fathers used to. Why, Kid, has this song stuck with you for so long?
Well, because it's a good song, and you know, and it is it's just a good song. But also, I play Gun Club songs and Cramp songs in my set because there is no one to play them anymore. Both groups are long gone, and there's really, it doesn't seem like anyone with any authority from those groups is really outplaying them. So to me, it's a way to say hello to Jeffrey and say hello to Lux and Nick Noxon, those who are not there. And to keep that alive, and plus it makes people happy.
You've been around the music industry for a minute, and I wonder if there, I mean, what you're hearing today, coming out of studios today, coming off the stage today, is there anything exciting that you see?
Yeah, there's a million bands that are great. And from Los Angeles, the Linda Lindas are very exciting.
Yeah.
Young female band. Just a young band. And I like another LA band called The Tracks, who are from Boyle Heights. And they're like a really great Chicano band playing rock and roll music that has more to do with The Cure and Echo and the Bunnymen than Mexican roots, but the roots are still there. It's very interesting stuff all over.
And what keeps it going for you? I mean, is it because you see so much good stuff out there even today?
Well, I don't know what else to do, but and it's what I do. It's my life's work. It keeps me engaged and interested and listening to other what's out there. And it is a communication with people.
Well, Kid Congo Powers, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about your new book, which, by the way, is out today. You're going to be doing a reading and a signing too, right? Tomorrow night at Stories?
At Stories Books in Echo Park, 7 p.m. in conversation with Ian Svenonius.
Learn more about that at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Kid Congo Powers, thank you, my friend.
It's been a pleasure.
Onward with KCRW's Greater LA, I'm Steve Chiotakis. It is an investment the MacArthur Foundation makes for each of its yearly fellows and their potential. And this year, that genius grant of $800,000 is going to someone right in LA's own backyard. Marta Gonzalez of Claremont is the type of person who needs a lot of slashes to describe what she does. Associate professor in the Intercollegiate Department of Chicano and Latino Studies at the Claremont Colleges, director of the Scripps Humanities Institute, and if those things weren't enough, also a singer, songwriter, and self-proclaimed artivista, which we'll explain in a moment. And Marta joins us right now. Hey there, congratulations to you.
Hey, thank you. Thank you so much.
What's it feel like to be a genius?
You know, I don't believe in that part of the award at all. And I think most most folks would agree with me.
Let's talk about Art de Vista, because that's the one that has the biggest question mark over my head. What is an Art de Vista?
Okay, well, Art de Vista for me, and for a lot of folks that I know from my generation, is quite different than just saying artist activist. I think that when we talk about artist activist, usually you think of an artist who is, you know, moving along their careers and include social justice, you know, things that have to do with community and in their the content of their work, right? And use their music, art, or whatever the medium is as messaging tools, right? But as an artivista for me is somebody who does what an artist activist does, but also utilizes their skill sets to develop out methodologies that include others in the making of art and music, right? So, and really focusing on process as a valuable tool. The idea here is that we use our skill sets more than just to proliferate our own careers and our mediums as messaging tools, but also as ways of bringing communities into doing the work of creating music and engaging in important processes, centering the process.
And you're the singer and songwriter and percussionist of the Grammy-winning rock band Quetzal, right? Where do you find inspiration as a musician?
Well, in my community, right? What I see in my communities, the relationships I build with them individually, collectively, but as well as my, you know, my students, my colleagues, all the amazing thinkers that I've had the pleasure of learning from and working with, and the urgency of the world, right? And I think music really grounds me in a way that it's not just about putting out fires, you know, consistently and responding to the urgencies of the world and social movement, right? That's a lifelong struggle. But I think that because I work through the medium of music, it's really generative. I try to also utilize music as a generative tool and a way of kind of trying to imagine a kind of future that, you know, that is more just and, you know, and has a lot more hope in, for the world, right?
Well, hope for the world. I mean, we all hope for the world, certainly. And there's a lot to hope for sure. You're also a dancer. I mean, you teach dance in addition to all of this. You teach fandango. What are the origins of it? Where did you first learn about it?
Yeah, the fandango is actually interdisciplinary as well, right? It's the roots are, it's native to the state of Veracruz. It's participatory, meaning that and intergenerational, right? So it's a basic, for lack of a better word, it's a kind of fiesta that has roots in Spanish, indigenous to the region, as well as African influences, being that Veracruz was all part of early slave trade. And so, you know, all of these influences have melded into what we now know as the Son Jarocho. The Son Jarocho is the genre of music born out of fandango, which is the community fiesta. And, you know, it has poetry, it has dance, it has the song. There's wonderful music attached to it. One of the most famous sones in the repertoire is called La Bamba. So I know you know the music, but very few people know that the music, there's a repertoire, an extensive repertoire of over 120 sones that you could possibly hear in a fandango fiesta. So the participatory nature of it is what has been inspiring to communities as of late here all over the world, but particularly in the U.S. But it's the practice of the fandango that has been the most inspiring lately, because it really cultivates community building. It's just has made people really think about their lives beyond buying of records, right? And then they start building out other ways of being and knowing, right? So it's a huge community that I'm one small part of.
How do you juggle all of this, Marta? Good Lord, there is so much going on in your world.
Well, like I said, you know, music for me has always been something that's just a part of my life. I grew up with music, right? And I think that really thinking about, you know, of course, like my work doesn't call for the end of, you know, music as a profession. that's not it, right? I do that part. Like you said, I'm part of Quetzal, right? And we do this thing, right? And we our content in our music is about social justice and Chicana identity and you know, feminism and things of that sort. And then we come across folks like the Zapatistas, right, who instigate our, who really are pushing us to think about music in other ways and not just in relation to market capitalism, right? So in that way, you start noticing movements around the world. It's a zeitgeist, right? People are thinking about other ways of being together, of building out the world we want to see, and not just responding to emergencies and you know, these urgent matters. And that's important to do, but it's also important to build on the dream, right? And I think that Fandango has been very instrumental in helping us to do that. But it gives us energy, right? It doesn't just take from us the way other kinds of movements might at times, right? So it's sort of, it's all interrelated, and music is a thread that is really tying all of these worlds in. And, you know, and I mean, I get tired and I need sleep at night, but I think music is what music is what gives me, continues to give me that energy, right? It doesn't just take from me. Music is always, has a way of nourishing the body, the mind, the spirit, and keeps you going in many ways. But I can't tell you, I don't need a vacation from time to time. That, and that's of course generative, but even on vacations, right? We play, I sing with my family. I play with my son and my husband, and who's the founder of Quetzal. And, you know, music is just our way of life. And it just permeates so many different aspects of our lives. And it's never tiring, never.
And it certainly connects a lot of people. So I get it. And I just want to congratulate you again. And thank you for coming on and talking to us. Marta Gonzalez, musician, scholar, activista, and most recently, now a MacArthur Fellow. Congratulations, Marta.
Thank you, sir. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
That's going to do it for us this evening. Later on KCRW and into tomorrow on Morning Edition and on Greater LA, updates on the LA City Council, which just today chose Paul Krikorian as its new president to replace Nuri Martinez, who resigned her seat last week in light of those racist recordings that came out. We're going to have an update on the City Council tomorrow on GLA. Today you heard about Congressional District 41, and if you want more information about this year's midterms, you can check out our website, kcrw.com/election. All kinds of information there you can use to help you decide in election 2022. That's kcrw.com/election. And while you're at the website, subscribe to the podcast, too. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your time and attention, and of course, your ears this evening. Have a great night.